This week in the markets, gold added about $12 and the XAU climbed above support. Welcome back to Gold Seek Radio, everyone. Your host, Chris Waltzek. We have another encore episode for you today with four big guests, including Jim Rogers, Peter Eliades, Dr. Chris Martinson, and Jeffrey Nichols. Robert Ian wraps up the show with an encore editorial, and next week we return with an all-new episode. We'd like for you to stay with us right here. Jim Rogers from his office in Singapore. Jim Rogers, financial author, commentator, hedge fund manager, co-founder of the Quantum Fund, and the author of several bestsellers. Welcome back.
I'm delighted to be here. It's always fun.
Thanks for joining us. And, you know, we've had an interesting run this year in the precious metals. Certainly caught a lot of folks off guard. The strength in the XAU, for instance, nearly a 200% from trough to peak in just 6 months. Is this a blip on the radar screen, or is this something more substantial in your estimation?
Well, gold and precious metals have been going down for several years, as you know, 4 or 5 years. And it's normal to have a rally in any bear market. To me, it's a blip on the radar screen. To me, it's not real. We've had several of these since 2011, as I know you know better than most. So I'm not buying yet. I expect more corrections and more opportunities.
U.S. equities, you know, we've had a seven-day rout. There hasn't been a trend emerge in the major indexes. It's been just sine waving for about a year, year and a half.
There hasn't been a trend. It's been mainly that the big stocks are going up and everything else is going down. In 2015, even though the averages were fine, twice as many stocks went down on the New York Stock Exchange as went up. I repeat, twice as many stocks went down as went up. Even though if you looked at the averages, you would think, wow, things are great in the U.S. economy and the U.S. stock market. The same thing is happening now. Most stock markets around the world are down this year. But if you just look at the New York Stock Exchange averages, you would think, my gosh, world is great. Unfortunately, the world is not great, as anybody out there in the street can tell you.
We haven't had a chance yet this year to find out what Jim Rogers thinks about the sea change event there in the Euro, the European Union, Brexit. It seems as though it was somewhat of a close call, 48 to 52%, but the people spoke. How does this impact the Eurozone? Will it break up the EU, or will they just simply reorganize and sort out the problems?
Well, first, we need to remember that whenever the people are unhappy with the economy, it's always the economy that starts people being unhappy. They blame somebody. They always try to blame the foreigners, especially the foreigners, and it's happened throughout. It's happening in the U.S. right now. It's a common thing. So that's what happened in the U.K. It does certainly going to mean a reorganization of the EU. Unfortunately, I don't see how the EU can survive as we know it. The European Union, and the European currency, a great concept, and the world needs something like that. Unfortunately, it was badly executed. You know, everybody used phony bookkeeping. Everybody cheats on their accounting, so they say they're better off than they are, and that's catching up with us. So the euro, as we know it, will not survive, and the EU, as we know it, will not survive. The question is, will anything survive? First of all, when you have changes like this, it's going to cause turmoil, as we saw when the Brexit vote took place. But second, can the world survive? I don't know. You see more turmoil if other current countries leave or other people want to leave the currency. That's going to cause turmoil. And you may have more votes of people wanting to leave their own countries. There are Spanish who want to get out of Spain. There are Italians who want to get out of Italy. There are Belgians who want to. There are many in nearly every country in Europe. There's some people who want to get out of the country as it exists now. So those votes, whichever way they go, will cause turmoil, and you will have more countries voting to get out of the EU. Whether they go out or don't go out doesn't matter. The turmoil is what I'm talking about. So we have a lot more turmoil coming. Be worried.
It's ironic because I know a lot of folks who emigrated into the U.S., hardest working people I have ever run across. And I think you're right. The people at the bottom of the political totem pole have a tendency to be scapegoated, vilified, ostracized, and this is a theme that we've seen for hundreds of years. So I think it's a fantastic point. But I'd like to move on, though. Negative interest rate scenario, $13 trillion worldwide. A lot of exposure to interest rates. Everyone says rates can never go up. Do you see this negative interest rate theme continuing? And will U.S. policymakers eventually throw their hat into the negative rate ring?
Well, what's happening is, since negative rates are so common throughout the world, more and more people are putting their money into the U.S. That's one reason the U.S. stock market appears to be high. They need to get income. Whether they buy U.S. bonds or U.S. stocks, whatever, they've got to have income. And in the U.S., we still have positive interest rates. So that's bringing more money to the U.S., and therefore the U.S. dollar will go higher. And that's just going to make more distortions. People are buying the dollar not because the dollar is sound, because it's a place where they can get positive interest rates. No, all this artificial stuff that we're experiencing right now is going to end very, very badly.
As we wrap up today, is there anything else that you're watching closely? Maybe the mainstream media hasn't yet picked up.
I talked about buying agriculture before. I would certainly continue to buy agriculture. You just be very, very worried, because I mentioned the distortion of money going into the U.S. dollar. I own a lot of U.S. dollars, but that's a distortion. I don't approve of it economically, but it's happening, so I have to invest accordingly. But that's going to really distort a lot of markets around the world. Just listen to your program and be knowledgeable, because if you become knowledgeable, you will get very worried, and then you will get prepared. We're really going to have some problems in the next couple of years.
That's right, and buy Jim Rogers' books as well from Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble. Thanks for making time for us this morning.
I'm delighted. Thank you.
The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity. Brazil Resources, based in the eighth largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves. Industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank. And founding director, their São Jorge project is 100% owned, with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their Ria project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond. Your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Peter Leides, editor and publisher of Stock Market Cycles, in the markets for many decades. It's a pleasure to have him back on the show. Welcome back, Peter Leides.
Thanks a lot, Chris. I appreciate that. It kind of makes me feel old when you say many decades in the market, but it's true. I believe that we are, in terms of price and magnitude of moves, I believe we're very close to a market top. But having said that, I will also say that on the intermediate term, short to intermediate term, I think we are, in fact, we may be at a market top, but I don't believe it's going to be the final market top. There are so many things happening internally in the market, Chris, in terms of strength and breadth and advanced decline line and 52-week highs that intimate that if this is going to be a top, then it's not going to last very long, that there should be a higher high after this, or at least a test of these highs with the kind of divergences we like to begin to see at market tops. We have not seen those divergences yet, and that's one of the main reasons why it does not make sense that we're at a top here. On the other hand, if we look at things on a more fundamental basis, and I very seldom do that, but there certainly is a very strong argument, as you stated, that money has to go somewhere, and right now, we look like the only game in town to a lot of people with a lot of money.
I wonder if you could tell your thoughts on the market sentiment. It seems a bit frothy. The put-to-call ratio and several other metrics just seem to indicate that maybe bullishness has reached almost a fevered pitch.
Yeah, I would agree with that also. I don't know as that goes so far to say a fevered pitch, but it is certainly in many metrics as high or higher than it's been in quite a long period of time. In fact, we could argue that it's higher now and many measurement factors than it was at the highs in May of 2015 for most of the market averages. And let's also point out, Chris, that the New York Composite Index, which is theoretically at least the most broadly based of all market measurements with every stock on the New York Exchange, has not yet gone to a new high above the May 2015 highs. That high, by the way, was one that I did not think would be broken by either the Dow or the S&P. And now that it has been, I think we really are living on borrowed time here. I can see this extending into the fall. But, of course, the fall is only a couple of months away now, and we get ourselves a decent decline here and then a move back to these levels with, as I said earlier, the kind of deterioration internally in the market that I think is required to see an important top. And we may be looking at something that's a lot more important.
A few years ago, you could count on virtually a good, solid 3, 4, 5, 7% return on a diversified portfolio. Those days they're just gone. It's ancient history. You're lucky to earn 1, 2% dividend yields, of course, across the board on the S&P. And, of course, the price-to-earnings ratio, very extended relative to historic norms. We have the bond market as well, reaching extremely frothy levels simultaneously. This just doesn't traditionally occur, tend to be more negatively correlated, that is, stocks and bonds. Can you give us some reasoning behind it, or would you prefer to stick with the technicals?
Well, I think you've hit upon the exact reasoning for it, Chris, and that is that they're, let's look at it this way. The people we have to feel sorry for, and I'm moving into that category myself, are the people that have worked hard all their lives, amassed themselves a certain amount of money that they figured they could retire on, a comfortable interest rate, conservatively gained at 5, 6, maybe even 7% if they were lucky, and they'd be set for the rest of their lives. Well, guess what they're getting now? You know as well as I do that they can't make 1% on their money. So if you're faced with that after these decades of hard work and labor, figuring you'd be okay if you amassed a certain amount of money, they now have to become seekers of market return, and they go out and do things they should not be doing. They should not be putting money in places where there is risk involved. But indeed, that's the only place where they have any promise at all of making money. So that becomes a huge problem, and it's a problem that in pretty big fashion and not too far away. But it's hard to put your finger on exactly when the price is going to start to be paid for all of that. I mean, what rising interest rates are going to do is finally make these people, the fixed income people that have worked for so long to get themselves some money they can retire with, a little happier. But on the other hand, that's going to completely rip apart our system that is so heavily based on debt right now, both on an individual consumer basis and on the governmental basis. So it's almost a no-win proposition, Chris, in terms of the next 2 or 3 years.
I don't think a host could ask for a better segue into alternatives to the paper assets, because chasing a yield is just a non sequitur at this point. It really leaves us in a bind as investors, and we start searching around for value, better relative value. And of course, near the beginning of this year, investors said, wait, there's value, especially in a negative rate environment, over $13 trillion worldwide now in debt and sovereign debt gone into negative territory. That really makes precious metals an intriguing alternative. And whether or not you like them or not, or whether you even allocate any to a portfolio or not, the story is compelling now after many tough years.
Yeah, I used to follow the precious metals markets a lot more closely than I do now, Chris. But certainly on a long time being around basis, saying that, you know, we know, although some people might argue, but gold is really the ultimate money, and that there is definitely value there. The question becomes, what are people willing to trade up for? What kind of risk are they willing to take? I mean, the old expression used to be that an ounce of gold would always buy a good quality man's suit. I don't know what that means anymore, because you can get a decent quality man's suit for $300 or $400, but the kind of quality that we're talking about may be more like $1,000 or $2,000 suit. So is gold overpriced here? I don't believe it is, but it's obviously in a situation where it faces what we might all be facing, and that is a deflationary situation. And I'm just not smart enough to know what's going to happen with gold in a deflationary situation. I can give you an argument for a move in either direction. I think the most important area to touch on, and it's not a timing tool, and it doesn't tell us where the market's going to be next month, next week, or next year, but we are, without question, once again, and it's happened now three times in the last decade and a half, in one of the most overvalued markets in history. I would encourage, I don't know if you ever speak to him in terms of interview, Chris, but I would encourage your subscribers and your listeners to listen to Hussman of Hussman Econometrics. He's got a website. It's free. It doesn't cost any money. Go and look at his interpretation of where we are valuation-wise, and he actually has a valuation metric and that has worked over a long period of time, over the last century, let's say, as opposed to the so-called Federal Reserve valuations and all these little game-playing things out there that really have nothing to do with true value or undervalued or overvalued measurements in the stock market. We are truly at one of the most overvalued levels in the history of the stock markets.
Everyone listening to Peter Leidy's voice today will have links for you. Just click those links at the website or the email as you come across it. Really interesting information at the HussmanFunds.com. I think that's the one you're referring to.
Yes, it is. And he does a weekly commentary. I don't know what it's listed under, but it's on his main website. And I think it's under weekly commentary.
He shares your idea, basic premise on market cycles and themes and biases. Very interesting reading. So I hope folks will look into that there. We'll definitely put up the links there, as well as to Peter Leidy's market cycles as well. Hope you have an excellent summer sabbatical.
Always fun to talk to you, Chris. Thank you.
The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity, Brazil Resources. Based in the eighth largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves, industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank, and founding director. Their São Jorge project is 100% owned, with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their RIA project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember, to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond, your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice. Louis Navalier runs Navalier & Associates and is also editor of four leading stock advisory newsletters. Welcome back, Louis Navalier.
Great to be here.
You know, I wanted to talk to you about your latest report. You talk about corporate earnings. Now, clearly, this is a key component to every equities bull market. You know, after all, even Warren Buffett has shown for decades that steady, predictable earnings, a key to success. Although it's not as sexy maybe as the high-flying stocks, the reliability of earnings seems to win in the long run. In your latest newsletter, you do outline how this is the best announcement season that you've seen in years. Tell us some more, please.
You know, I just finished doing my emerging growth letter. To say the earnings are strong is a bit of an understatement. My average sales this last quarter were up 70.6%, and earnings were up a whopping 374.4%. Now, that's as good as it's ever going to get. For the third quarter, they're supposed to decelerate. Sales are supposed to decelerate to an annual pace of 52.6, and earnings are supposed to decelerate to about 147.8. Now, I have earnings surprise on average. The analysts have revised their estimates higher, so I'll probably do better than that. But the reason earnings momentum has just peaked here is the dollar's gotten strong. And earnings were being fueled by a weak dollar that was driving commodity prices higher. And companies were reaping windfall profits from their overseas business. So all of a sudden now we're more in a deflationary environment where we've got falling food and energy prices, and earnings will decelerate here a bit even though the economy looks fine. But the other good thing that's going on is they can't raise rates. Britain and the U.S. said they're going to raise rates. Now they say, no, not till wages go up. And global yields collapsed in August, you know, when the German 10-year bond crossed below 1%. It's almost been cut in half this year. And now there's this global capital flight, all this, these trillions of dollars that central banks have pumped in and sloshing all over the place. And one of the recipients is the U.S. stock market. And that's why we went up in August in light volume. It's a very, very exciting time.
I wonder if you could outline a few companies with solid prospects. I know that you keep a core group without giving anything proprietary away. Maybe a few companies that you like.
Well, let's talk about, I have a little drone company. I have a big one called Northrop Grumman, makes the Global Hawk drone. But my little one is AVAV. That's AeroVironment. Apple Victor. They just reported 35% sales growth. Their earnings were up even in a more impressive 1,000%. And there's not good analyst estimates on this company, but they're a classic example of one I expect a surprise from. Because last I saw, the drone business is pretty good, especially at police departments and things like that. Another good example of a company that's supposed to have just blowout earnings is Ring Energy, REI. Their sales forecast the next quarter is supposed to be up 408%. Earnings supposed to be up 1,550%. Obviously, they got a bunch of new wells on, and I know gas and crude oil prices are soft, but you know they got all these new wells coming on board, and so they're going to have just stunning sales and earnings growth. So you know the fracking business is very, very good. Our biggest winner, which we still like, in fact, we bought more of it today, is Vishop Holdings, VIPS. This is a Chinese, like basically a Chinese Amazon, but they make money. You know, Amazon in the United States forgets to make money every now and then. And their sales are forecast to be up 125% next quarter, and their earnings supposed to be 183%. So that's just stunning. I mean, it's just stunning. So I've got lots of earnings. Earnings are not a problem. The biggest problem we have is that we're starting to enter a deflationary environment, so we're going to have to be very careful of some of our energy-related stocks. But this looks awfully good right now.
Tell us some more about deflationary environment. You know, you talk about the Fed holding rates low for the foreseeable future in the newsletter because they keep rattling that saber with regard to higher rates. But the other side of the pond there, the ECB lowered its rates now, as I know you know, into negative territory. First time that I can remember in history that a major central bank lowered rates below zero.
Our Fed's being somewhat responsible by trying to wind down quantitative easing. It should be wound down by October. Now, because they've done all this money pumping, they've gone from a $800 billion balance sheet in 2008 to a $4.5 trillion balance sheet. And they've taken over $2 trillion of that to shore up the mortgage-backed market. it just doesn't hit on all cylinders now. So they tried to save that market, and they were successful, but they're not going to give all this money back. They're going to keep that $4.5 trillion balance sheet. With interest, we'll get up to $5 trillion, and they're going to continue to manipulate interest rates. The big problem and the big event that caused the market to rally in August was European yields. Even though our GDP resurged to 4% annual pace in the second quarter, that was a preliminary number, it's going to get revised. Europe basically went into recession. You've got Germany, France, and Italy all either flat or contracting. That freaked everybody out. Their yields plummeted. And the European Central Bank is out of control on their money pumping. You know, they basically told their member banks to go ahead and borrow at 1% and go buy the government bonds. So they drove the bond yields for Greece, Italy, Portugal, Spain dramatically lower. You know, Spain bond yields, 10-year bond yields, fell below U.S. yields this year. And, in fact, Spain's at the lowest interest rate since 1789. And that's trillions of dollars. The banks in Europe are so busy arbitraging, you know, borrowing from the ECB at 1% and buying something with a higher yield, they forgot how to lend. So they would park their excess reserves with the European Central Bank, and they charge them negative rates. And then basically the ECB is saying, hey, go out and lend this money. Well, guess what happens when you're lazy? You don't want to do that. So all of a sudden the U.S. dollar started to rally, so they just started to dump their money over here. So they're getting a currency tailwind, okay? Plus they're buying our yields, and they're going lower, which is a short-term appreciation. And so it's the European money that is actually driving our yields now lower. And, you know, it's a very small world out there. It's pretty amusing. So, you know, our central bank action was coordinated, and it seems to be not coordinated anymore, although they just got together at Jackson Hole in Wyoming, and I think they had a little chat now that they're a little bit more coordinated all of a sudden.
This month is a particularly challenging one for Wall Street. Traders on sabbatical. You also point out that the lull could be a good buying opportunity, though, for conservative A-rated stocks.
We should rally go into Labor Day weekend, like we go into most holiday weekends. If you look, we rallied into Memorial Day weekend. We rallied in July 4th weekend. We're going to rally into Labor Day weekend because people are going to be happy. We will cringe around September 11th because of all the chaos in the world, but that'll be a good buying opportunity then. Hopefully nothing bad will happen. But the drop-dead date for everybody to get in, the last person in the pool, is September 30th. So historically, in a midterm election year, September 30th has been the best buying point, and we rally going into the midterm elections. Obviously, we're going to have more gridlock after the midterms, as you do in most midterms. Wall Street loves gridlock. Apparently, government can't do anything. And so the private sector will just grow and prosper regardless of government. And then we get all the seasonal surge. We're still going to have a very good third quarter earnings announcement season. Not quite as strong as it was in the second quarter. But and then you hit the happy time of year. You know, from Thanksgiving of the year, the markets traditionally rally. There's year-end pension funding. People are happy in the holidays, and that rubs off on the stock market, and you often have a nice small cap rally. I mean, August has been very significant because we've rallied with no volume. And so August was really capital flight from fixed income investors seeking yield. You know, stock market still yields over 2%. That's more than the bank. It's tax advantaged. But it was really not only U.S. capital flight, international capital flight, and then, of course, if we can rally with no volume in the seasonally strongest month, it's a big deal. And corporate buybacks are definitely picking up. CNBC's out there broadcasting buybacks are slowing down. They don't know what happened in August. They're going off of old data. I can tell you, because I have 37 stocks buying back $1 billion or more a year, the buybacks picked up big time in August.
And you show quite an interesting graphic there, which illustrates the significance of buybacks relative to stocks. But I wonder if you could give us more of a specific view of how this fuels value. I mean, obviously, there's fewer shares out there. Supply and demand dictates that we'll have a higher price. Tell us more, please.
Well, sure. One of the more controversial stocks I own is Lockheed Martin. It yields about over 3%. It's retired almost 40% of its float. So what people don't realize is that we may be cutting back, but our allies are buying like crazy. And, of course, there's all that tension in the world, so that's good. And then finally, so that gets their sales up. But Lockheed's a huge IT company. They have been stabilizing their stock with their dividend and relentless stock buybacks. Their dividend payouts are actually lower than they were a few years ago because they bought back over 40% of their stock. But when a CFO buys back his stock, his earnings per share go up. So let's just say earnings are flat, okay, and he buys back 10% of outstanding stock, his earnings per share will go up 10%. So relentless corporate buybacks are boosting underlying earnings per share. Now, a lot of people will say, well, this is financial engineering. This is smoke and mirrors. Well, yeah, it is. But every kid that goes to business school learns about finance 101, whether they should borrow in the debt or equity markets. And what happens is if Wall Street doesn't price your stock right, and you have my average large cap stock has a return equity of 28%, and if they can borrow at 3 or 4 and buy their stock back with that high return equity, their earnings per share is going to soar. And so when you have relatively low price earnings ratios, as we do now, you know, our average large cap stocks barely at 15 times forecasted earnings, and you can borrow at such low rates, you're going to keep borrowing, buying your stock back. My average large cap stock is going to be gone in 18 years. It looks like the buyback pace is picking up, so I'm going to have to revise that to 15 years. So it's whether this is right or wrong, this is what's happening, and this is a big, big deal. And that's why every dip is a buying opportunity, and that's why the market can't have a big correction, because corporate America is waiting for every little dip out there to buy their stock back.
I want all of our listeners to really digest what you've pointed out, because I think this is key. Essentially, you like the fact that we have a low interest rate environment, because this allows big caps, in particular with strong return on equities, to have a cash buffer between what they're borrowing at and the liquidity and cash that they have on hand. That is cash that has to be put to use, and we don't have a rip-roaring economy, so they're buying back their shares.
Correct. And, you know, corporate America also has two sets of books. They have domestic treasury and international treasury. And so, you know, a lot of people wondered, how did Navalier end up in Reno, Nevada? Well, it's pretty simple. I'm from California, and guess where the California companies and the big Washington companies like Microsoft keep their cash? Reno, okay? Apple, Cisco, Oracle, Intel, the Intuit founders, my neighbor. Microsoft's the biggest employer there, and Amazon's huge there. So they're running their cash through Reno because they don't want to have the corporate taxes on their domestic revenue. Now, what's happening is then they have their international treasury. Now, that's going to be in Ireland or Singapore or someplace else. Now, as these companies build up all this cash overseas, it burns a hole in their pocket, and it's fine if they want to expand. They will not repatriate that money because they don't want to pay the tax differential. You know, so if you pay 25%, say, in Canada, and you want to bring it back to the United States, you got to pay another 14%. So what they do is they leave that cash overseas, it burns a hole in their pocket, and they often will use that money to buy their stock back and or, okay, use that collateral over there to borrow extra cheap over here, which is exactly what Apple did. You know, Apple got up to $179 billion overseas, so they could just borrow extra cheap because they have all this money sloshing over there. So, you know, there's this big gossip about inversions on stuff. I can tell you, forget it, the S&P 500 is not chartered in the United States anymore. It's been gone for years, okay? Don't ask me why the financial media is talking about this now. They left a long time ago. You cannot find a big U.S. energy company headquartered in the United States. They're, you know, Halliburton's Qatar, Transocean is Swiss.
But what about Sunoco? I love Sunoco.
Well, you know, I have to check that. You know, MEMC Electronics, Mountain View, California, that's Cayman Islands. Seagate Technology was Ireland for a long time. I mean, just don't be surprised, okay? So, you know, obviously a lot of the pharmaceutical companies are Irish, you know. But the bottom line is, you know, these companies go to the low tax havens, they keep their cash there, that cash has been burned a hole in their pocket, and if they don't know how to invest it, they just buy their stock back. So the buybacks are not, I don't see them ending. I mean, you know, if Wall Street doesn't price a stock properly, corporate America has every right to go back and buy their stock back, and that's exactly what's happening. So this is very, very exciting. This is not being told by the media. You know, Herb Greenberg loves to get up and demonize buybacks.
Also wanted to ask you about the, you know, the latest Fed's minutes there. I mean, we saw a sea change, you might say, at least in the general sentiment, and we're starting to hear some hawkish talk coming from the Fed. But you aren't buying it. You think this is, you know, they're just trying to talk the markets down. What do you think?
Well, first of all, the hawks are a minority at the Fed. And Charles Posner, I believe, voted against what the Fed statement was last time. He's to say he's hot as a pistol is an understatement. He's PO'd, okay? So the bottom line is you have a lot of progressive people to Fed trying to fix everything by throwing money at it. And Janet Yellen, our new Fed chairman, is a labor economist. And she came up with her own indicator, 19-component indicator, to explain that even though the unemployment rate fell, the job market isn't fixed and the Fed hasn't fulfilled its unemployment mandate. So she's looking at there's too many temp jobs. You know, a lot of companies are still keeping people under 30 hours a week because they don't want to pay for their health care because the costs are uncertain. Even if the costs were certain, there's a Cadillac tax coming in 2018. I know I'm personally going to get hit with that for my health plan. It's too generous. I mean, I got to strip something out like anesthesia or something. But I think the government makes me have that anyway. So they're going to try to throw me to an exchange. So because our health plan is just too generous. So what's happened is they're keeping the people under 30 hours a week. The labor force participation is a 36-year low. And the most ironic thing is the folks over 55 are working more than ever. Now, there's this myth that the labor force participation is a 36-year low because the baby boom's turning gray. But then how come everybody over 55 is working more than ever? So in this era where, 80's the new 60 because you can't retire with low rates, the job market is really, really messed up right now. There's no wage growth, which is really Yellen's big thing. There's too many temp jobs. And the core of the workforce, 25 to 54, is not recovered yet, okay? There was some hope in recent months, but it's just not recovered. So until we get some wage growth and more full-time jobs, they're going to keep pumping, and this could be for years. And I don't mean to be political on you, but, you know, Eric Cantor is the guy that was close to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and he got defeated because he wanted this immigration reform. Because you had companies like Darden Restaurants and Marriott pushing him big time that we need more foreigners and temporary work visas. And, you know, I happen to live in South Florida, so I see this. You know, you go to hotels, you go to restaurants, you'll get people that are from somewhere else, you know, South Africa or Peru or some other place, and they're there for 6 months and they disappear. And you see the same thing at a ski resort. A foreigner on a temporary work visa is cheaper than hiring an American or legal alien. Because if you hire an American or legal alien and you let them go when the season turns down, you've got to give them unemployment. You know, the whole hotel and restaurant business has figured this out, okay, and so is the ski industry. So what's happened is we need more of those foreigners and temporary work visas, at least the big companies are lobbying Congress for it, and that's been pushing immigration reform under the surface. Obviously, you know, it didn't get through because Eric Cantor got lost, but this is one of the things that, you know, still might get through.
But what do you say to folks who point to Canada, which has relatively low immigration, but, you know, the younger crowd fills that void for menial or, let's say, manual labor? They pick in the fields. They work in the hotels. They work, you know, behind the scenes, bussing tables. The argument that's being made there is this creates a, let's call it an economic backstop for the middle class.
Well, let me be very clear on Canada. I know Canada a little bit too well. My wife's Canadian. In fact, I can still make my kids Canadian before they're 18 if I wanted to, in case there's a draft or something. But the truth of the matter is Canada doubled its population in the last 30 years, and they did double it with very orderly immigration. But the Canadian immigration is a little different. They basically, when you're up there, they say, got any money? 475, I think, now. Mm-hmm. But used to be a quarter million. And so basically you can immigrate there if you bring money. Now, you can immigrate to the United States if you bring money, too. Okay, and I personally think the easiest way to solve all our fiscal problems is to let about 100 million new immigrants in with 2 million each. And also, you want all those people that go to our fancy universities to basically give them a work visa if possible. You know, if you go to Microsoft and Redmond, it is India. For some reason, India makes more programmers than other countries. So Redmond is India. Well, they can't get all the programmers in, so they got them up in British Columbia. And, you know, it's going to get to the point where Microsoft's going to be a lot bigger outside of the United States than in it, and that's all because of the work visa problem. So it's interesting what's happening in America, but I think we do want to look to Canada. You know, whether we like it or not, Social Security and some of these other things seem to be pyramid schemes, so we need to get more people paying in, and that's another thing we might want to do.
Well, you know, I will point back to India and just note that for decades, there was a huge push for technical skills, particularly with programming all throughout the country there. If you had one of the higher scores in your community, you could get an almost fully paid spot at the university. So it really drove that programming / computering skill set for decades. Also wanted to ask you a bit more, though, about this inflation outlook. Rates and inflation will be back on the table as, I think, a key component in the markets.
Normally, the money pumping results of inflation, but the velocity of money, how fast money changes hands, is turned down. So near term, what's happened is the dollar rally, last I looked at euros at a one-year low and the dollars at a one-year high, the dollar rally is shoving all commodity prices down. Doesn't matter whether it's precious metals, wheat, corn, soybeans. There are exceptions. Copper prices are up. Beef prices are still high. Hog prices are firm. But the truth of the matter is that the strong dollar caused food and energy prices to decline near term. So, and also, this is the time of year where energy will turn down. Turns down in the fall. We've had an unusually cool summer. It's global cooling, I guess, is going to cause it to turn down a bit. But in the fall, naturally does that. So it's gone for now, but it will come back. You just can't have all this money sloshing around not cause inflation.
Well, I'd also point to palladium, which, as you know, Russia, the number one producer, there's some concern there could be supply disruption issues due to the Ukraine drama.
And platinum as well, because platinum comes from Russia and South Africa, and South Africa likes to have like a 40-day strike.
Yep, they just wrapped up the latest. Okay, I want to ask you, though, about your geopolitical standpoint. Now, we're seeing a lot of trouble in the Ukraine standoff. We also have Gaza, and then we have Iraq, a trifecta, if you will. Tell us more.
I should be very, very careful. I bought a whole bunch of defense stocks early this year. Didn't they know that this is the most peaceful time in history? Okay, what's happening is they're selling to our allies because of all the tension in the world. Now that tension is broken out. We're very proud that we own Raytheon, which is the Iron Dome at protecting Israel. And, what Israel does is if a missile's coming in and it's going to land in the field, they won't shoot it down. But if it's going to go to an urban area, they'll shoot it down. It's 20 grand to shoot down each one. So Raytheon's done very, very well. The spy business is great. So the drone business, Northrop Grumman, AVAV, that small drone company, it's just phenomenal. Finally, IT business is good. Spying is good, as Lockheed Martin is. I've got a HII, which does all the Navy ships. Had very good earnings. Astronics, another new one I'm adding. They're selling a lot to the Defense Department. There may be a void in the world. We may not be protecting as many people as we used to, but the arms business is very good. In fact, I actually bicycle with a guy who was sanctioned by the UN and is an arms dealer. He's happy. This is the greatest environment it's ever been for him, and he just thinks Putin's a great guy. I mean, because it's good for his business. So it's what's happened in the Ukraine is very tragic. Obviously Russia wants their oil pipelines or their natural gas pipelines to be flowing freely. There was an alternative pipeline they were trying to build around Ukraine that they're not too crazy about. They know Europe's not going to do a lot, but Russia did hurt their currency when they did this. They joined the emerging market crisis, and what's going on is not very acute. Now, as far as Gaza's concerned, I mean, obviously, you've got to take out Hamas, and because they're launching missiles, and the head of Hamas is worth $2.6 billion. Arafat, used to live in Switzerland. So it's unfortunate that they've had these leaders that are, less than ideal, but they've signed their death warrant. And then we'll see what happens with ISIS now. I mean, obviously we're trying to protect the Kurds, and we got the dam back, and we'll have to see how all this unfolds. The world's a bit of a mess. And as sirens go off, you got 15 seconds for all the shrapnel comes down. I go to Israel a lot. It's a long story why I go there, but you got to get underground. You got to get somewhere safe because even when you shoot it down, the shrapnel's coming.
Any positive comments? My guess is that you'll be looking for some type of capitulation in the next 6 to 12 months in the precious metals that might lead to a bargain buying opportunity.
Well, gold never did retest its low. It might have to do that. But the chaos in the world is good for the precious metals. I just think they're reacting negatively to the dollar right now. It's I think as the chaos builds, you know, it might firm up a bit. You know, the Indian wedding season is over. You've had some central bank selling that hurt the gold market. We took the sanctions off of Iran. Iran was in oil for gold deals. Now they do oil for dollar deals. So, you know, it's interesting. You know, gold's just in a trading range, and I think people have to realize that. But if the market's going to go down for about 14 days, I guarantee you gold will be the best performer. And as you mentioned, the platinum, the palladium plays, those are industrial metals that everybody needs, and the supply sources are very suspect right now. So those are not bad places to other precious metals to look at. Silver is just much more volatile. I wish I could give people good advice on silver. My main advice is just take gold and make it three times more volatile.
Well, I wonder if you could tell folks more about the services that you provide at Navalier Advisor.
We're a money management firm. We manage a few billion dollars. We don't count our bond business, which is over a billion a year, but basically we're a money management firm. We have a free stock grader out there that people want to take advantage of. Our dividend grader launches in early September. You have to grade stocks differently for dividends than you do for stocks. So at NavalierGrowth.com, you can go there and see how your stocks rank. If you'd like us to do the portfolio checkup for you, we're honored to do that. We give free portfolio checkups, but we are an institutional manager. We have big institutional accounts, billion-dollar accounts. We charge pretty low fees if we do manage money, but the other thing that's odd about us is we're one of the few managers who work for incentive fee. We like to charge 10% of profits once a year. The SEC restricts on who's available for that, but that's become very popular on fixed income or dividend-type accounts nowadays. Fees are a very sensitive issue on yield, so we prefer to just charge 10% of profits once a year, and we wait a whole year to bill. And then I'm a huge investor myself. You know, I have a new fund out there I started. It's my third fund. It's growing rapidly. I have money in all my funds, so we have a lot of fun out there.
Louis Navalier, we want to thank you for your time, and also a hat tip for being one of the sharpest advisors with a really solid track record. Very difficult industry to have that moniker, and we're going to look forward to having you back on GoldSeek.com radio. Well, it's a pleasure to welcome back Jeffrey Nichols, Senior Economic Advisor to Roslyn Capital, at the helm with Marin Alexov. Welcome back, Jeffrey Nichols.
Happy to be here today. Thank you.
You penned an interesting article recently regarding the founders of this nation, their penchant for the yellow metal and for silver. You mentioned names that everyone will recognize: Washington, Adams, Jefferson, Hamilton, Franklin, Madison.
Today they'd all be thought of as gold bugs.
They tied the U.S. dollar to the value, and most of our listeners are aware of this, of around 370 ounces of silver and around 25 grains of pure gold, this bimetallic standard in the United States. Now we have neither. We have neither a gold nor a silver standard whatsoever. Why don't we start off with what their intentions were?
Well, I think their intentions were to protect the value of their savings and investments. I think that, you know, we had the continental dollar, which was the unit of currency that literally financed the revolution, but it was also a currency that was inflating quite rapidly. And the founding fathers knew that if they put their money in continental dollars, it wouldn't be worth much after a short period of time. And so they favored gold as a store of value, a reliable way to hold their assets and what wealth they had, those that did have wealth.
This was the currency forerunner of the U.S. dollar. Some of our listeners will be familiar with the term "not worth a continental." Expenses incurred during war led to devaluation of the continental, to where, of course, runaway rampant inflation, similar to Venezuela, there were shortages of food. There's some really big implications of removing the dollar from the metal standard. So why don't we talk a bit more, though, about this bimetallic standard? You know, silver recently touched 75-1 on the gold-to-silver ratio, and this might actually be undervaluing silver relative to gold.
Well, actually, I think that quite the opposite. I think that silver is probably overvalued relative to gold because, after all, it remains today still principally an industrial metal, much more so than a investment metal. And as an industrial metal, it has to face the vagaries of how the economy performs. And I think the U.S. and the European and, in fact, the other major economies, China, Japan, India, are likely to have years of disappointing economic performance. And those who expect commodities, particularly metals, including silver, to do really well are going to be disappointed, I think, because the demand just isn't going to be there from the industrial side.
I see the industrial aspect as its greatest strength, that it's a monetary metal. Gold has virtually zero industrial demand, whereas silver has an inelastic industrial demand, making it the most, my personal opinion, undervalued asset in the history of mankind. And I would argue you would likely see a much closer ratio of 20 to 1 in the coming years. I mean, even if we put that all aside for a moment, we say we stay at the 75 to 1 ratio, I'm sure you'd agree that as gold appreciates, silver virtually appreciates.
I agree. Silver is going to do well in part because gold is doing well. And gold's appreciation over the next few years will spill over into the gold market, if you will. The large-scale investors who are buying gold are not as welcoming of silver.
Stanley Druckenmiller.
Soros. They're not looking at silver. They're looking at gold.
If I were a billionaire, as they both are, I would only be looking at gold. Why would I waste my time with something that's 75 times less expensive? I'd have to have, you know, a warehouse to store my silver and guards around the clock. Because from my perspective, it's precisely because the smart money is buying gold that silver will have much greater demand than gold, because there is a 10 to 1 ratio in the ground and above ground in reserves of gold to silver. And as the populace wakes up to inflation, it could very well return to its monetary status.
What's important to keep in mind also is that we're not looking at strictly a U.S. market. It's a global marketplace for these metals. And when we take into account the affinity for gold in India and China and other Asian economies, there's a strong predilection for gold that just isn't there for silver. And we're looking at these countries to be one of the factors that propel gold and along with it, silver higher too. But what they're really buying is gold, and their affinity is towards gold. I mean, for example, look at the central banks. Central banks have been buying gold, importantly, the Chinese, the Russians, a few others, but they're not interested in silver reserves. They're interested in gold reserves. I think that's all there is to say about it.
Take a look at India and China. They have a huge interest in silver, especially India. And as gold becomes more scarce and more expensive, silver could very well be the only way to invest in precious metals for the everyday investor, or not even investor, person on the street. But we both do and can agree that we will see silver and gold move higher in tandem.
Absolutely. I think, you know, the key here is that precious metals are going to perform very well over the decade ahead. And looking at gold, I think we're going to see record high prices to the extent that many investors are going to be surprised that gold could possibly move that high. And if you have a strong market for gold, you're going to have a strong market for silver. So we shouldn't really quibble over which is best or which is, you know, going to outperform. Let's just say that they're both going to do very well. They both are going to provide investors with a hedge against risks to financial markets. They're both a way of diversifying one's assets. And they're both offering protection should we have rising inflation and a weaker dollar.
I agree with you on the diversification qualities of the sector. I would highly recommend having close to an equal weighting of gold and silver, however you wish to make that ratio. That, of course, is up to the individual. I'd like to shift the discussion over to interest rates. You have touched on this a bit. Obviously, negative interest rates in Europe and Japan, and now spreading around the world, presents a best of world scenario for any asset which does not incur a rate penalty, which a savings rate does under a negative rate environment. Give us your thoughts here, please.
Well, first of all, I think it's important to look at what we call the real rate of interest, that is the nominal rate adjusted for inflation. And when you look at the real rate, we're already below zero interest rates. After adjustment for inflation, investors and savers who put their money in a bank account are losing real value. They're not seeing any appreciation in their underlying asset. And that's important to keep in mind, because we could see, and probably will see, some rise at some point in the Fed funds rate and other short-term rates. But at the same time, you're going to see inflation beginning to accelerate, and hence the real rate of interest is going to be close to zero, or even more likely somewhat negative in the next few years.
Can you give us some forward guidance regarding the Fed's actions? I mean, they've obviously backpedaled a bit on the rate hikes, and it looks as though we may not, according to the current Fed funds futures contract, see a rate hike this year.
We've been talking about that for as long as I can remember. I believe the U.S. and global economy is in what some economists call secular stagnation. And with a secular stagnation expectation, the Fed is going to be persistently disappointed in forecasts of a recovering economy. It's going to feel at some point obliged to take new or greater steps towards monetary ease, trying to stimulate the economy out of the doldrums. And that's what is going to continue to present the possibility of higher inflation in the years ahead, even though people are looking at CPI, you know, barely moving. I think those of us who go grocery shopping know that there's certainly some underlying inflation. And if you look at the stock market, stocks are grossly inflated. Fine art is grossly inflated. Apartments here in New York City are greatly inflated. So in some sense, we already do have an inflation underway. It's an inflation of those selected assets that I just rattled off and some others. The dollar is, as a consequence, losing value. It's just that it's not terribly visible to most at the moment.
We obviously have this underlying trend, if you will, or bias of higher prices within everyday goods and services. That hurts those on fixed income the most, which is really a double blow.
The buying power of their savings is diminishing, and it's diminishing to some extent surreptitiously. It's sort of an invisible tax. Inflation has been called an invisible tax, and for those on fixed incomes or with retirement pensions, their assets are falling in real value. What they could buy yesterday was more than they can buy tomorrow.
If there weren't 47, 48 million food stamp holders, obviously we'd have many, many hungry folks and maybe even worse social conditions. But I'm curious if that is acting as a leveling mechanism to hold everyday goods and services at an artificial ceiling.
Yeah, I think, you know, obviously there are too many Americans who are finding it difficult to make ends meet. And I think this is where the politics of it all comes in. The reason we've seen such a strong interest in Donald Trump, for example, or even Bernie Sanders at the other end of the extreme, is that so many Americans are dissatisfied with the status quo when it comes to their standard of living. And apart from a small minority, standards of living are generally declining. This is another aspect of the invisible inflation that's taking place. And so it's affecting the whole political and eventually the social fabric of America. And it's something that is going to have to be addressed one way or the other. It's either going to be addressed by more food stamps, if you will, or lower taxes. And you can take your choice. But in the end, whatever happens, I think gold, and for that matter, silver, since you brought it up earlier, are going to be assets that buck the trend and provide protection against inflation, whether it's inflation of financial assets and real estate or of consumer goods.
What odds would you put on a potential for a retest or even eclipsing the former bull market high for the yellow metal?
Oh, I think we're going to see it reach its historic peak possibly by year end or the first half of next year. And from there, we're going to start seeing gold make new highs, eventually rising to a multiple of the current price. But that's a 3, 5, 7 year forecast.
Exactly. So the idea here is obviously capitalize on these lower prices or discounted prices while they're here. Don't worry too much about the timing. And you also mention in some of your literature that you like a 5 to 10% portfolio ratio of precious metals. Tell us more, please.
Well, I think you want to have a basic foundation of gold with physical gold within a portfolio to protect it from depreciation of all sorts, particularly rising inflation, a weaker dollar, and financial risks offsetting weakness in the stock market and bond markets, for example. But there are times, and we may be at a time like that now, where risks are higher and the recommendation to buy gold might be larger. But importantly, what I'm talking about with the 5 to 10% rule is for that much in physical gold, preferably small bars and bullion coins, such as the American Eagle or the Maple Leaf or the Krugerrand. And that's a core investment that you want to have and hold. It's not for trading. If you're interested in trading, that comes on top of the 5 to 10%. And if you're interested in mining shares, that comes on top of the 5 to 10%. But you want to have that core position as an insurance policy. You hope and pray that you don't need it in the future, because if you do, it means that everything else is suffering. It's like buying insurance on a house is often the way it's presented. You buy insurance on a house and hope that you don't have a fire, not that you collect on the insurance.
But I would go one step further. I'd say it's an enhanced insurance policy. But, you know, when we pay a monthly premium, for the most part, that premium disappears unless we collect. Even if your gold and silver insurance policies on your investment portfolio and your family's savings and all that you've worked for does not pay off, then you still have one of the most difficult to obtain substances on Earth, which always, over time, maintains purchasing power and usually defeats inflation on a long-term basis. So any other topicality that might be relevant today?
I think it's important to remember that we're talking about a world market where India and China and a number of other countries play a very significant role. And what we've seen in the gold market in the last few years is a major shift of physical metal from Western investors, that's in the United States and Europe, the hedge funds and the institutions that are interested in gold. They have been generally sellers in the past few years, but we've moved into a period now where they're becoming buyers, not to make a quick gain, as a hedge fund portfolio manager might be interested, but as a long-term holding that they'll probably never sell, and they'll pass it along to their heirs. So it's not going to come back to the market the way an investment in the West might come back to the market, and indeed has come back to the market in recent months, quarters, and the last few years. And as a consequence, we're going to see prices move much higher than anybody today really anticipates, except for maybe a few of us.
Exactly. You know, the future, very difficult to predict. But at the same time, we do have pockets of probability. The late Dr. Mandelbrot pointed out, you know, in chaos theory, and we certainly see some signs of very solid odds and probabilities on the upside. You talked about how in India, there is a strong tendency to procure metals and try to hold and maintain them within a family structure. But I'd also point out that, you know, temples, Buddhist temples, Hindu temples, have a tendency to use the metal on structures, on rooftops, on buildings, in within statues, within artwork, things of this nature that sometimes last for millennia. You can sell jewelry from China around the world, but for the most part, they do not encourage and block most gold exports from China.
I talk about it as being gold available supply. The available supply, that is gold that can come into the market, has been diminishing. Gold has been moving from available supply to unavailable supply, except at very high prices, that metal is removed. And as Westerners decide once again that maybe they want to hold a few more ounces, they're going to have to pay up at a higher price level than they might have previously imagined.
Any other contact information to share with the listeners?
Well, I think that the important thing is that Rosalind Capital is committed to providing precious metals physical to its customers at fair prices and with as much ease as possible. They like to see an educated consumer and investor. And that's one of the reasons why we write the Rosalind Gold and Silver Commentaries every few weeks, so that the investors are educated about some of the thoughts we've talked about today. Nice being with you, Chris.
The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity. Brazil Resources, based in the eighth largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves. Industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank. And founding director, their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their RIA project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond. Your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
It's a pleasure to welcome back Dr. Chris Martinson to the show, author of a new book, Prosper, How to Prepare for the Future and Create a World Worth Inheriting, as well as the head of peakprosperity.com. That's all one word, peakprosperity.com. Welcome back, Dr. Martinson.
Well, it's very nice to be back with you today. We're really approaching not just a cyclical end game, but really something much larger. We're in the end game stages, I consider, of a fiat money experiment, really born on August 15, 1971, when the world decided to abandon gold as a tether, and we became untethered. And so what happened since? Well, we fell into this fantasy that debt could, and increasing debt could replace savings and true prosperity. We've been borrowing at twice the rate of underlying income growth, we meaning the whole world, really. China catching up, you know, like gangbusters in the last few years, but the United States led the way. And we led the way on this really unfortunate idea that somehow we could borrow money at twice the rate our income was growing. Bad idea. We had a warning shot in 2008, decided as a nation and as a world that we're going to double down on that particular bet, get the quote-unquote credit markets repaired, which just meant transitioning unsustainable borrowing from the private sector to the public sphere. And so here we are. To sustain that fantasy, that illusion, requires over $10 trillion of negative interest rates in the world right now, continued central bank interventions, which are increasing in severity and frequency. And all of this has led to people, rightly, feeling really anxious, concerned, and confused if they're not paying attention, and downright frightened if they are.
We have some very bright listeners, not pandering to the audience, but simply, it's just true. I mean, I've had the pleasure now for over a decade and to correspond with many of our listeners, phone calls, etc. Very successful in their areas, their field, because there seems to be a convergence or a confluence of interest in economics as people mature, for obvious reasons. And as we look at this dilemma, we've been in the blogosphere and around the internet for so long. We have had this, the sky is falling, ideology since the year 2000. I think people have reached a point where the level of negativity, which obviously sells newsletters and sells books and sells tapes and audio and CDs and, you know, makes catchy website names, but it sells and that brings in revenues and it brings in advertisers and things of that nature. Why is this time different?
I certainly am very sympathetic to the idea of crisis fatigue. I suffered from it myself. This is all stretched out far, far too long. Listen, for people who are alert and paying attention, it's enormously frustrating to see something that's wrong, it's obviously wrong, and yet it persists. And we might even notice that in this particular election cycle, for anybody who wants to look at it, it is clear and obvious that there is fraud and rigging and vote miscounting happening with electronic tally machines absolutely statistically churning out results that are impossible, and yet it persists. You would think something as fundamental, as important, with two equally matched sides, both interested in getting the, you know, the result they want, that somehow this would be brought to light, but it persists. And Jesse Livermore said it way back in the 30s, which is the market can remain irrational longer than you can remain solvent. And that's the basic idea, and it's not just markets, it's that the human condition allows us to exist in a state of denial for a really long time. Not in a healthy way either. That denial, of course, leads us further down the path. So this time, to me, is going to be different. This is going to be a very long topping process, making a very large stop, because, Chris, this is the mother of all bubbles. This is the sovereign credit bubble.
I like the idea there of crisis fatigue. We were early on the trend, the 2008-2009 crisis, the financial crisis, the credit crisis, what some people refer to as the Great Recession, which I think is a pretty apt moniker. I mean, without somewhere between $700 million and $3 trillion in just U.S. bailouts, we've heard numbers tossed out there as much as $10 to $12 trillion that the Fed gave to the European Union just to help keep it afloat so it didn't sink us. A massive amount of monetary stimulus and QE operations for decades now. Coordinated efforts among the three top central bankers at least to keep the Titanic from sinking. And I think what you're saying is, well, you know, all they did was plug the hole. And inevitably, the ship must right itself or capsize.
Well, absolutely. If we back up just two big steps, we say this is all a giant math problem. At the highest level, and this is something I've talked with economists about, and I just personally interviewed Rana Faruhar, the managing editor of Time, their economics correspondent, who wrote a great book called Makers and Takers. And I posed her this question because she's got great access to you know, very high-level people. And I said, if we take the idea that our economy and our money system is requiring infinite growth on a finite planet, is anybody talking about that? And she thought it was a great question and said, no, it's everybody, you know, could clearly work out that that's a big giant thing. That's an issue we need to think about, but we're not doing it. And so when you ask me, is this, you know, what's it going to take and how bad could this be? In my mind, this is going to be really bad, because once enough people figure out that there are hundreds of trillions of dollars of claims on an economy that can no longer grow for a variety of demographic, structural, resource-based, and debt-based reasons. It's this big, giant, swirling, cauldron of reasons. Once enough people work that out, you know, the next question is, well, where do they go with their hundreds of trillions of paper claims? And the answer is they try and all squeeze out through some very, very small doorways, which would be called real assets or hard productive assets or productive enterprises. And I think we're going to see a real scramble at some point in the future, and it'll be messy, and it'll be chaotic. And I think we'll discover that having high-frequency trading platforms out there that can operate in a millisecond is a bad thing, not a good thing.
Maybe that's a subject for another episode, because I was heavily involved with extremely high frequency trading through the Forex market using robotic algorithms and MetaTrader and whatnot. Published that online, you know, an average of 89% to 93% win rate over 600 documented trades through Zulu Trade. I question maybe some of the hype surrounding that. And although there's been, you know, some interesting research in the area, maybe it's the high frequency trading through much larger institutions, not individuals. What I really wanted to get to, the swirling cauldron, as you call it, or let's call it a downward vortex, perhaps. The coordinated efforts of these individuals have magically been able to keep the edifice from imploding. Huge inflows that have obviously been a major component, other than obviously buybacks and things of that nature, of our stock market rally since 2009. This was not fomented by the Fed alone. Huge inflows from troubled areas around the world. Could there be more than just economics at play? Could it be that we're viewed as the least sick in the ward?
Well, no, not only, excuse me, are we the least sick patient in the ward here in the United States? We still, believe it or not, are one of the least corrupt places, one of the places that you could actually move capital and have the most confidence that, you know, you'll be able to keep it there. So that explains a huge amount of the global capital flows that have been transpiring. Obviously, China's been a huge engine of capital formation, not least of which is because they've piled on $20+ trillion of debt in just the last 8 years, and that creates money that got siphoned, and some of it was real value creation, and some was the usual financialization spin-off profits. And those have been circling the globe looking for a place to be safe, because the people in China rightly do not trust how their own country is going to behave in a big correction of some kind, which everybody knows is coming. We don't know when. But yes, the tricks that the powers that be can pull off are huge. And in the United States, there's been no accountability for anybody at any level who's operating in the financial sphere. It's kind of like the untouchables of times past. I would greatly love to see an actual, true, and complete audit of the Fed, just to find out what have they been up to. I'm supposed to trust that their balance sheet is fair, free, and complete. I don't trust that. And so we've seen the central banks of the world pass this baton from one to the next, from, you know, United States Federal Reserve to the Bank of Japan, over to the ECB, back to the Fed, and now back to the ECB in the form of €85 billion a month. The ECB is buying corporate bonds now. That is just it's an incredible flood of money, and it's hugely distorting, and it's at least part of the explanation for why we see money flooding anywhere, somewhere, into the U.S. stock market, helping to power it higher.
I don't want to say it's a bleak scenario, because I know there's light at the end of this tunnel. Help us see just how we can prepare our families, our communities, and our nation for what you see coming.
Well, certainly. I think the prescription is the same at all different levels. It's fractal, so it applies everywhere. And the first thing is, you have to be prepared for the idea that there will be a large debt deflation coming. We have all this debt. It's outstanding. The question isn't, can it be paid back? The only question remaining is, who's going to take the losses? So either it gets defaulted on, or there's haircuts, or something has to happen. But at any rate, when we get into a debt deflation, if you are an individual and you're owning lots of non-productive debt, like you're carrying a mortgage that's right at the edge of your capability to afford given your paycheck, debt's a stone-cold killer in a deflation. I think that everything that the central banks have tried to do has not ignited the kind of inflation that would actually be beneficial. They always say they want inflation like it's just generally beneficial. It's not true. You want wage inflation, that helps. Having my healthcare costs go up, that doesn't help. So they're trying to ignite this inflation. They've been unsuccessful. Negative interest rates have actually made the process worse, not better. They haven't figured that out yet, but they will. And so at this point, I would say people should be out of debt as much as possible. You should absolutely have some gold and silver, but mostly gold at this stage, as a form of insurance against a monetary accident. There will be one of those in the future if we don't get off of this credit train. And then to build cash reserves, because what you want to do is be ready for the bargains that are coming. I'm not of the view that you know, this is one final vortex of suckage to the bottom. I think we've got many more cycles in front of us. They will be painful, but this is going to be an extremely painful cycle. So having no debt or low debt, cash and gold is a good position to be in. This is a very defensive strategy, but I don't see that the upside potential here is all that good.
I think that the scenario you've outlined here is much more realistic. Okay, we had a 2008-2009. We might see something similar. We might see something worse, but it's inevitable. And, of course, they will, you know, do everything they can to keep cogs spinning. But eventually, the end game might not be next year. It might be 20, 30 years down the road. There's just too many variables in this multivariate problem. So we're going to skip that and just say, look, okay, we see a trend, a theme, a bias unfolding within the economic data. It sounds like a positive for the energy sector, which was battered over the past several years. And that all came to a crescendo with oil under $30 a barrel for a very brief period of time. Since then, you know, we've been bouncing around 50, which is a remarkable recovery.
50 is wonderful compared to 28, but it's still not enough to support nearly all of the shale plays. And by which I mean, if you looked at all of the territory in the Bakken or the Eagle Ford or the Woodford or any of the shale plays, some very small select percentage of those plays in terms of footprint would make sense at 50 because those are the ultra sweet spots. But it turns out maybe 90% of those plays do not make sense at this price. So that's part one. Part two, none of the deep water plays make sense at anything less than 100. So those are our new marginal forms of oil creation and development. Those are offline right now. The world is chugging along on the oil finds that we invested in a while back. We know that we've had a huge shortfall in capital expenditures on upstream development in 2014, 15, and now 16. So those holes in CapEx are going to create future holes in supply. What does the price have to be in order to support new supply coming online? Well, 80 or higher. I think 100 makes a lot more sense. So we're going to have to see higher oil prices in the future. You know, whether a world awash in $200-plus trillion in debt likes high oil prices, that's a different question. But more microscopically, I think the energy space has nowhere to go but up. But it still could have, Chris, some rocky points between here and there, particularly if this global slowdown that we're tracking right now really takes hold. That could really punish the demand side of this story. The possibility, I don't think it's clear sailing yet.
Move back to the precious metals. Obviously, there are so many ways that we can analyze the precious metals and the prospects on a forward basis. Clearly, you are looking for better times ahead. Are there more important or coincidental metrics that help craft this idea of a solid bull trend unfolding in the precious metals?
I am not even remotely an investor in gold and silver at this point because of inflation. That's not anywhere on my radar screen, and it really hasn't been. The correlation between gold and inflation is kind of poor in the United States and more generally globally. Few local places it's done well, you know, if you looked at Venezuela or Zimbabwe. But that's really just tracking the dollar as well. So you would have done as well in those as gold and as being in the dollar when those hyperinflations were happening. Could people start thinking of it as an inflation hedge? Maybe. The reason I love gold and I'm really heavily invested in it is because it's my insurance policy against what I consider to be an inevitable financial disaster, a really big accident, something worse than 2008 by far. This could include sovereign defaults. There's going to be more institutional defaults. As we mentioned before, there's just an enormous pile of losses that have to be recognized. It'll just be a scramble to figure out who's going to eat them. With derivatives, we can't really know. And the one thing I love is how gold behaves in moments of financial uncertainty where nobody knows who owes whom what. And that's what's coming. And I think that gold is going to do well, particularly in a deflationary environment, because of that uncertainty factor, because it still counts as tier one capital, because let's face it, gold is money. You know, even Greenspan says that now, and now more recently, Mervyn King. I mean, we've got all these ex-central bankers, once they go into retirement, suddenly speaking the truth.
Former Fed head Alan Greenspan's recent comments, which are really mind-boggling to hear this level-headed intellectual PhD in economics even think about the idea of martial law coming to the United States compared us to Venezuela. I mean, obviously, you need to crystallize any wealth that's remaining. This is against the backdrop of a country where something like 80% of the, you know, inhabitants of the U.S. can't even put together $400 for an emergency check. I don't say that glibly, paycheck to paycheck. And ironically, even though they're able-bodied or of sound mind, body, and age classified as viable workers, they cannot find jobs. And those that have found jobs are underemployed, which, as I think Robert Kiyosaki also pointed out so well, tends to lead to unemployability on a forward basis. And with 25 to 35-year-olds, the millennials now, overwhelmingly living at home in their parents' basements, and that just erodes the potential for house purchases and families down the road, unlike the baby boomer generation, which, you know, was the backbone. So if I understand you correctly, you're less concerned about inflation, which we've obviously seen lately, although, of course, the greenback suffering sharply here. You're really more interested in the systemic risk, and there's a lot of nervousness around the world in this race to the bottom. Do you care to give people an idea of just how, you know, a bull market in the yellow metal will unfold this time, and whether or not you think shares, which are essentially leveraged play on the metals, could fare?
Well, the shares, to start there, they could fare very well, obviously. And, you know, that's always a possibility. I, like many people, have been soundly disappointed by the ability of many of the gold companies to properly manage their free cash flows and to generate free cash flows during a rising price for their underlying metal. So I think, you know, you need to pick those shares carefully. I really believe in due diligence. There are a lot of good companies, great companies, and dodgy ones in the space, just like any space. So I like to be picky about which ones I like to really look at. And then the way I'm really thinking, you know, here everybody's tracking gold in dollars right now. How many dollars is it per ounce? Eventually that flips, and people start thinking, well, wait a minute, how many ounces per dollar? And then eventually we get to decouple from that, and people go, well, forget dollars, because those are those are gyrating all over the place. This is my key metric, and the reason I accumulated gold was that I said to myself, look, when I can trade an ounce of gold for an acre of productive land, I'll start making that trade and swapping away from gold back into something productive. I think that when the dust settles from this, and that could be 10 years from now, could be 100 years, could be 2 years, I don't know, but when the dust settles, people once again realize that paper money, stocks, bonds, all those things, those aren't real wealth. Those are claims on wealth. What's real wealth? It's real things. It's things that take actual energy, actual effort to produce, or they're productive enterprises. It's good farmland. It's timberland with value. It's really productive real estate of some kind. It's the means of production, whether that's small or medium-sized businesses, large businesses, that have access to the resources they need to do what they do. Those are the true engines of wealth. We've just forgotten and got wandered away from that and believe that capital formation is something that can be printed out of thin air. Like, that's what the Federal Reserve has been trying to do. The efforts they went to preserve capitalism, and I would note ironically that they've kind of said in order to save the baby, we have to kill it. Because what's been practiced these last, I don't know, 7 years now in this so-called Great Recovery from the Great Recession has been anything but capitalism, which is real people, real enterprises, creating real value, taking the excess surplus of those efforts and plowing that back into productive investments. That whole machine has been broken. Corporations have been doing share buybacks, which is financial engineering. They have not been plowing back into R&D, property, plant, and equipment, and CapEx, things like that. We've had financial speculation running amok. We've had very little investment in the future in this country in terms of actual infrastructure, real changes to education that are meaningful, et cetera, and so on. So it's all kind of just been papering over. You said plug the hole in the Titanic. It's really, yeah, they just papered over the hole and crossed their fingers and hoped magically that we'd get this, you know, turnaround like we've always had in history. And they've been confused because they were looking at the wrong stuff. They fundamentally didn't understand what they were up to. And negative interest rates are just absolutely, even within their own sphere of study, they didn't understand psychologically what a negative interest rate really means.
I mean, if we look at Barsky and Summers, you know, negative interest rates, put it this way, the impetus behind a strong gold bull markets. And keep in mind, I'm talking about negative real rates of return, which is a little different than negative interest rates. But still, I mean, that's what you wind up with when you have a negative interest rate and even further into negative territory. We're almost victims of our own success in the United States. So let's say the West in general. We've had prosperity and stability within our political, for the most part, and economic system, but had a solid basis that we've forgotten what it's like to have, you know, a worst of all worlds, Venezuela, style implosion in our economy. That's where your idea of I won't trade an ounce of this precious metal until its purchasing power is truly reestablished. In order for that to occur, it's going to take an entirely new mindset.
Let me just plug the book Prosper for a second, because we have eight ideas of capital formation for people in there. Finance is just one of them. We've covered finance today. Gold and silver and all those other things show up in that chapter. But we want to point people to the idea that in these really uncertain times that there are other forms of capital that are going to be extremely important for you to have, including living capital, which is your own health. Of course, everything starts with that. You have nothing if you don't have your health. So living capital is very important. I'm looking out at my garden and orchard right now, which is another expression of living capital. Social capital, very important. Emotional capital, extremely important. Are you going to be a person who thrives or falls apart when the chips are down? These are a few examples of some of these other areas of capital. Very, very important. Some of them you can buy, some can't. But somebody who wants to truly be resilient, really wants to both be prepared for the future, but really living into today more fully, that's what the book is about. Financial capital is just one part. We say take care of that right up front. Here are the other areas to look at. And if you enhance these, your life will be better today. You'll be healthier. You'll be happier. You'll be more well-connected. And if the future goes this way, you will be in a position to be helpful to other people, not somebody needing help, as well as having access to fresh food. And so, yeah, I don't see it as work. I see it as a really healthy hobby and a practice for me. And it's meditative, too. I really find it soothing on many levels. But, you know, for somebody who's saying, yeah, I don't know, and it sounds hard and it sounds expensive, you know, the simplest thing you can do is you can go to Home Depot, you can buy a bag of topsoil. It'll be about $3 to $5, depending on what day you buy it on. And you can throw that right on your lawn, unopened, flat, and you can cut a slit in it, and you can put a potato in there. And cut a slit on the bottom, too, so it can get its roots out. You don't have to dig up any grass, which is a chore. You don't have to do anything. Just throw it down. And the next thing you know, you will be connected to your food production, because this potato will grow if you put it in the sun where it should be, not in the shade. And it's very easy to get started. I got my own garden started using what's called the lasagna method, where we put down layers of cardboard first. I didn't have to dig up grass. I did that for many years, you know, even rototilling, hard work. You just put the cardboard down, it kills the grass, and you just layer stuff right on top of that, leaves, compost, soil, if you want to buy that and put it on, and just start from there. So, yeah, the work involved, which some people will see as a barrier, can be minimized if you're smart about it. But once you get connected to the rhythm of growing your own food and eating your own food, I think most people, once they try it, get addicted to it, because it's soothing on so many levels.
It's not just for spring anymore. I mean, people think, well, you grow a garden in the spring or the summer. You can have wonderful winter crops. And in fact, to protect that topsoil that you've worked so hard to cultivate, winter kales, garlic grows primarily over the winter season, maybe harvesting some along the way, enriches the soil. And you're recognizing that as we give to, you know, the environment provides for us. And there are some lessons in here that I think transcend even into the investing world. If I do a good job investing with seed capital, if you will, I might wind up with many, many fold what I began with.
There are lots of approaches to doing the gardening piece. Just give it a try and get started. And I think really honestly, Chris, it's the reconnection to nature. It's the reconnection to the growth cycles. It's something we've lost. And I've just seen so many people find it. I use the word soothing, but I'll even say go further and say it has rescued some people, because we need that natural connection. Gardening is an easy way to get started.
And I would just point out that some of the top research in this area, Linus Pauling, Max Gershon, and some of the favorites that you and I have discussed, we won't get into that today, agree that natural sunlight, the fresh air, healthy exercise, you don't have to buy a $1,500 rototiller, for instance. I mean, God bless you if you have one, that's great. You can get a $79 electric one delivered to your door from Amazon. But I would even argue, as you said, you don't need need to do that. We don't need to tear up Mother Nature by simply using square foot gardening. You break down some cardboard boxes laying around the garage, if you will, or in the crawl space, and of course that stops weed production and growth. Layer in this year, if you like, grass clippings or leaves that were piled up in fall. Let worms and insects, and more importantly, fungi, do the work for you. By the end of fall or maybe spring, you're going to have great soil to work with. This is Goldseek. This is not Gardenseek. I'm sure our listeners, some of them, will appreciate this. And if we just convince one listener to put in a garden and increase, you know, health capital, that's a positive. Dr. Chris Martinson, it's always a pleasure. Please tell folks more about Prosper as well as Peak Prosperity.
Sure. I have a couple of books out. One of them is Prosper, co-authored with Adam Taggart, available on Amazon, also at our site, peakprosperity.com. And The Crash Course is the first book that I came out with. It's also a video series, very instructive for people who want to know why we are where we are today. And hopefully that gives some explanatory power and has some predictive power. Thank you so much.
Okay, Robert, thanks for another excellent installment. Well, that wraps up this week's GoldSeek.com radio episode. For two new big guests, be sure to check out next week's show. Until we talk to you again, have a great week.
This is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. All eyes have been on the UK 52-48 Brexit vote, which was in favor of the United Kingdom becoming the first country to leave the 28-member European Union. We're going to hear a lot about this vote and its implications going forward the next 2 years, because that's how long it's expected to undo the UK's role in the European Union. Before I comment on the importance of this 2-year window, let's discuss some of the topics that have been bandied about leading up to this historic vote. Limiting migration to ease pressure on housing, welfare, jobs, and wages has been a big one. EU regulations are another. Many argue the UK, on its own, could do more trade deals with rapidly growing economies around the world. Many believe the pound could fall by up to 20%. UK stocks could fall by nearly 25% due to confidence about trade with the EU, as large companies reassess their commitment to the UK. The IMF is predicting a recession. Unemployment is forecast to go up because an affirmative Brexit vote will put hundreds of thousands of jobs at risk and push up unemployment. And of course, in the wake of all this good news, the UK Treasury said the likely shock of an affirmative Brexit vote will blow a hole in the budget. So taxes will have to go up, and spending will have to be cut. Sounds like more austerity. Yet, despite all this good news, the Brexit vote still passed 52-48. But all of these fears and threats of what was going to happen on an affirmative Brexit vote, I suggest, was going to happen regardless of the outcome of the election. Let me say that again. All of the dire consequences from unemployment to currency and stock market declines and everything else have already been baked into the upcoming economic cycle in the UK and the EU. Now that Brexit has passed, we simply have a convenient excuse to anchor these circumstances, which were already coming and are unavoidable, into the public mind. Had Brexit not passed, the vote would have been close, and the narrative would be that confidence was still lost and was the cause for whatever ills followed in the marketplace. But those ills are coming regardless, because debt problems cannot be solved with more debt. A rebalancing must occur, and this is part of that process. Remember, it's going to take at least 2 years to renegotiate all the laws, rules, and regulations that intertwine the UK and the EU. That picture, that reality, may look very different 2 years from now than what people think they actually voted for today. 2 years of negotiations and recreating the art of the European deal could get very interesting, especially if the U.S. happens to elect someone who will be engaged in their own art of the deal on multiple stages throughout the world at the same time. Or, when it comes to the UK and the EU, the names might change, the places might change, but the UK story might ultimately remain the same. Kind of like the Hotel California. You can check out any time you like, but you can never leave. Only time will tell. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter at ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.
And a little encouragement for our burgeoning vegetarians and vegans here. You can save up to a million lives simply by just eating a vegetarian diet. You can start slowly. I mean, nowadays, veggie burgers and veggie alternatives are so tasty, you just can't tell the difference half the time. So it's really not necessary for us to put these animals through what they go through. We can have very healthy lives, and in fact, studies are showing currently that the typical male can add 10 years to his life and the typical lady 7 years to her life by simply switching to a vegetarian diet. It really benefits everyone all around, and you can save up to 10 lives a day by just switching over. Do the math on that. That's $4,000 or $5,000 a year. 10 years, you're in the neighborhood of 40 to 50,000. Before you know it, you've saved a quarter million lives over your lifetime. If you convince just four or five more other people, you saved a million lives. You contributed to it. The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity, Brazil Resources. Based in the 8th largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves, industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank, and founding director. Their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their RIA project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember, to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond, your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.